Everywhere within our environment, there are molecules that mimic estrogen. And the problem with that is that estrogen-like molecules engage with our body very similarly to how our endogenous estrogens do. This can throw our entire balance of not only estrogen out of whack, but other hormones that are related to estrogen as well. Women may experience bloating and swelling and tenderness, irregular menstrual periods, and both men and women may experience changes in sex drive as well as infertility. Changes in our estrogen levels also impact our mood and emotions. People can experience mood swings, anxiety, panic attacks, brain fog, memory problems, and the presence of excessive estrogen also leads to problems with metabolism and homeostasis. People may experience weight gain or hair loss, which may be a sign of problems with the thyroid system, difficulty regulating temperatures, especially within our hands and feet. We also may have changes in the hormonal governance of our sleep patterns via cortisol and melatonin, leading to insomnia at night and fatigue during the day. Today's episode is all about what are the estrogen-like molecules in our environment and how can we minimize our exposure to them and wade through often confusing research that seems to cast doubt about whether or not estrogen-like molecules are harmful for human health. Let's get to the show. Welcome to The Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast that helps you find fulfillment amidst chaos. On this show, I interview thought leaders, doctors, creatives, spiritual gurus, and game changers who inspire you to pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark. Dr. Anthony J. is the author of the best-selling book, Estrogeneration. He wrote the book to help people understand clearly and simply what estrogenic substances are, what are the most prevalent ones within our daily lives, and how can we take action to avoid the deleterious effects of exposure to synthetic estrogens throughout our entire life. Dr. J has a PhD from Boston University School of Medicine and has been a researching scientist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota for the past 3 years. He helps people through his consulting company analyze their DNA data to create personalized health care strategies that can help them to optimize their health. Dr. Anthony J., welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I am very, very intrigued by your work, and I especially love how you originally got into researching the prevalence and the dangers of artificial estrogens in our environment. And in reading your book, Estrogeneration, one of the most profound things is that we're surrounded by estrogens and that there's no way to get away from them in a lot of our daily life. Let's start our conversation by talking about where are we exposed to estrogens and artificial estrogens in our daily lives, and what are some of the most common words we can look for? What are some of the most common ingredients that might be out there that we can just start to tune our antennas about, like, ooh, this is an estrogen that's out there and it could be dangerous for me.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks. And yeah, these chemicals are troublemakers because a lot of the scientific research, and I'm a scientist, right? So I do some of this research myself. I have firsthand experience. A lot of the previous and ongoing research relates to toxicology. So scientists are literally putting some BPA or some phthalates or some parabens or some of these artificial estrogen chemicals on cells growing in a dish. And then they're looking to see whether that kills the cells or what's the dose that kills the cells. How much does it take to kill cells? And that's kind of a, you know, it's effective for a lot of things, for toxins, for different chemicals that are man-made. They're artificial. They're not found in nature. Problem is these chemicals are acting like estrogen. So it's not that shocking to your cells. Your body has estrogen. And so it's not a shocking thing to have a little bit more, you know, or some of these chemicals that act like estrogen. And so it usually doesn't kill the cells, unfortunately, because then scientists mislabel them as safe and not toxic and things like that historically. And then as you do more research and you realize it's disrupting all of these valuable sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen, there's actually three different types of estrogen in your body naturally. There's estrone, there's estriol, estradiol. So you start disrupting these things. There's other hormones like progesterone. And it's a really delicate balance and it can cause a lot of health issues. So, I mean, some of the big chemicals to look for generally relate to the plastics. You know, that's a big category. If you start, you know, drinking liquids out of plastics, whether they're hot or not, there's quite a bit of leaching. And, you know, BPA is a good historical example of that. But even if it's BPA free, there's a surprising number of estrogen chemicals to watch out for in plastics. You can definitely make plastics without them, but most companies don't. And it's a challenge to make plastics without these estrogen chemicals. And then another big category is personal care products. And you were asking about the ingredients specifically to look for, but unfortunately, a lot of personal care, they don't even list the ingredients, these at least related to these artificial estrogens, because they don't have to. They can use the word fragrance on the label, and they can literally hide all these chemicals in there. So you're looking for these chemicals and you come across the word fragrance or perfume, sometimes they use it, and they're legally allowed to just put them in there. And so that causes problems for the consumer looking to try and have decent quality products. So oftentimes you just have to trust the company. You have to understand whether they're looking out for you, and hopefully you can read all the ingredients on the list. But phthalates would be a big one on personal care products, and so would parabens, because scientists, I've talked to PhD scientists about those chemicals and why would you bother putting them in a fragrance, you know? And they'll say it's because, well, number one, it's filler, it's cheap. It's petroleum products, right? It's coming from oil, so it's really dirt cheap. But then number two, they make the argument that it carries the fragrance farther through the air. And so there is a logical explanation, but if it's causing harm to your health, it doesn't really, you know, like that extra foot that you might get from your fragrance scent or something like that is obviously not worth it. And it's a problem because even the shampoos, the conditioners, the soaps, people think they're washing that stuff off and it's going in the drain. But in reality, those estrogen chemicals love to absorb through your skin. They like to stay on your skin. They don't really like the water. It's called hydrophobic. They're hydrophobic. They're afraid of water, phobia. And so they prefer to stay on your skin. Your skin is fairly fatty. And the analogy I would use is chicken skin. You know, if you've heard people say, oh, don't eat the chicken skin, it's all fat. Well, it's not necessarily bad for you, but it is fatty for sure. And your skin is also fatty, so it stores up these estrogen chemicals.
So let's take a step back, because I think that we go through and we're like, okay, I have estrogen inside of my body. But I think that a lot of people don't understand how receptor chemistry works and how molecules can engage with our different receptors. And, you know, me as a pharmacist, I think it's fairly easy to understand how you can take an artificial estrogen pill that interacts with your estrogen receptor. But in reading your book, it sounds like that everything that you're recommending, the plastics that we eat and drink in our food, which I've heard it estimated that we eat about a credit card's worth of plastic a week is average. And people who aren't cognizant of these things may be eating much more. It sounds like that all of the estrogenic molecules that we're exposed to in personal care products that we absorb through our skin, absorb through our scalp, the plastics that we're ingesting, all engage with that estrogen receptor very similarly to how it would be if you take a pill. So talk to us about how receptors work. And I'd love for you to highlight one of the scariest things is that sometimes there is an irreversible binding of the estrogen receptor where the estrogen receptor just gets turned on and never gets turned off.
Exactly. Yeah. And scientists call that constitutively active. And they use those kinds of things in research studies to literally turn on receptors. It's like turning on a light switch, you know, and if you put super glue on the top of the light switch and turned it on, you wouldn't be able to turn it off. And you can do that with receptors. And we do it in studies all the time. You don't want to do that in your own body, but unfortunately there's the potential for that. We don't know for sure if that's happening, but it's certainly a high probability according to organic chemists I've talked to. And so basically going back to receptors, and I know you're looking through my book and you've read some of this, but you know, a lot of receptors and hormones, they don't act throughout your whole body. They just act in one specific place. Like leptin is the example I often use because that's a hunger hormone. And if you're eating a bunch of food, your fat cells secrete this hormone called leptin. And you don't have receptors in your liver. You don't have receptors in your muscle cells. So like leptin, this hormone is going through your body. It goes into your liver. It comes out of your liver. There's no receptors picking it out. It goes into your muscles, comes out of your muscles. There's no receptors picking it out. But when it gets to your brain, there's actually leptin receptors sticking out of cells that stick to it, bind it. And that tells your brain that you're full. Stop eating. But estrogen, unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, depending on how you look at it, but there's receptors through your whole body. So if you've got, you know, natural estrogen levels that are all dialed in, real precise, real optimized, it's excellent for you. And it has interactions with your brain. And that's why if you disrupt that, you see depression, you see mood disorders. But normally it's actually good for your brain. It's protective for your brain. If you're disrupting, you know, if you're going to see interactions with your liver, and if you disrupt that, you'll see clotting and various blood problems. There's interactions with your muscles, right? I mean, testosterone, estrogen, muscle development. There's a lot of different things, fertility. So you have estrogen receptors all throughout your body. But it's actually even more interesting than that, because I know you wanted to talk about soy at some point. So it's worth going into even more detail than normal. And I didn't even talk about this in my book, but it's worth going into more depth here, especially because you're a pharmacist. So testosterone, it's really simple. Just like men are really simple. Testosterone, it's testosterone. And then there's the testosterone receptor, which is called the androgen receptor that binds to testosterone. Really simple. Estrogen, there's three estrogens, right? There's estrone, there's estriol, and there's estradiol. So it's already more complicated than testosterone, unfortunately. So when people say, oh, estrogen, you're estrogen dominant, you have more estrogen, blah, blah. Well, there's actually three different ones. So it can get a little complicated. But not only that, it gets way more complicated because there's two different receptors that pick up estrogen. There's estrogen receptor alpha and estrogen receptor beta. And that gives it a whole other world of complexity, right? Because if you've got three different hormones and then you've got two different receptors picking them up, there's all kinds of variation there. So if you've got like one of the estrogens binding one of the receptors, it might do one thing, but then another estrogen binds that same receptor, it might do something else. And so, you know, the way to most simply look at, and scientists, by the way, scientists debate a lot about this, you know, so scientists will say, you know, estrone is a weak estrogen. And they've said that for you. And then you look at other studies and they'll say, we've researched this and the estrone is a strong estrogen, for example. So there's a lot of debate and it's very, contentious because it's complicated. So it depends what type of tissue you're looking at, which cells in your body, whether it's liver, whether it's, you know, gonads, whether it's your brain, there's so many different types of tissue. It gets complicated, but the easiest and simplest way to think about it is your alpha receptors. We have two, estrogen receptor alpha, estrogen receptor beta. It's kind of like having two light switches and they both kind of do different things. But alpha, if you're flipping on the alpha switch, if you're turning on estrogen receptor alpha, that's a stinker. That's a problem. Like most research looking at alpha is studying breast cancer for women, and they're studying prostate cancer for men. You don't want to be flipping on your alpha receptor. Now, why would we have the alpha receptor? Because it's very important for fetal development. So when you're in the womb and you're sexually developing, that's when you should be turning on the alpha receptor. That's when you want to be activating that particular receptor. Beyond that, you pretty much don't want a lot of alpha activation. And then the beta receptor, estrogen receptor beta, that one is the other way around. We're basically, that's super protective for prostate cancer in men. It's super protective for breast cancer in women. You can see the complications, right? Because you almost have two completely opposing situations between the estrogen receptor beta and alpha. And so that's where the estrogen is really beneficial. It's protective against Alzheimer's. You'll notice, like in studies, if you've got higher estrogen, you're more protected. And by the way, higher testosterone also, very protective for Alzheimer's, very protective for heart disease, etc. And that's because of the beta activation that you get from those estrogens, hopefully. And of course, you got to look at people's DNA, because some people have a genetic disposition to having more alpha receptors or more alpha receptor sensitivity. And that obviously complicates things, because, you know, if they're activating more alpha, they're increasing the risk of breast cancer, or again, prostate cancer for men, and a lot of other things like depression and other problems. So, and the reason I bring up all this complexity is because some of these estrogens, like soy, for example, there's a lot of debate about whether it's healthy for you, whether it's bad for you. And most of that debate centers around whether it activates the alpha receptor or whether it activates the beta receptor, because again, those are basically two different things. So it's not as simple as just, oh, there's estrogen and it's bad, or oh, there's estrogen and it's good. And really, one of the original studies regarding soy specifically was looking at the alpha receptor activation and beta receptor activation. And they found that, and Michael Greger, who's apparently, you know, a famous vegan, he has a YouTube video on this that people can watch. And he says, look, it activates the beta receptor, so it's really beneficial. And it's interesting, because I watched that video and I was like, oh, that's interesting. Let me look at the reference, right? Let me look up the study. And sure enough, figure one shows that soy activates the soy estrogen, which is called isoflavone. That activates the beta receptor, which is protective against prostate cancer, protective against breast cancer. All right. What's crazy, though, is that same study in figure two, they showed in a different type of cell in humans that soy activates the alpha receptor almost exclusively, meaning that you increase the risk for breast cancer, increase risk of prostate cancer. So another, and what the authors concluded in that study was, honestly, it's very inconclusive. That's the conclusion. We don't really know what's going on when you're activating both. So in other words, in different people, you get a widely different response. In different cells in your body, you're getting a widely different response. It's a little bit risky. But just again, focusing on soy specifically, the first most important thing to recognize, and I know you know this, but everybody agrees that it acts like estrogen. You know, sometimes I get people that say, oh, soy doesn't act like estrogen. Well, all the scientists agree with that. So the debate comes up whether or not it's healthy for you, whether it's harmful, or whether it's kind of neutral. And the answer to that really is that it depends on the person, and the research is super complicated, and money gets involved because there's a lot of financial incentive to promote soy, and it's a huge business in America. You know, and I mean, coffee and soy and corn and gold and silver, these are all commodities. So it's literally like a financial currency. So that's obviously a factor you have to factor in, because that can easily bias things. Money is very powerful in our country with politicians. But the point is, like, you know, there's a complex situation going on with these estrogens, and certainly plant estrogens, they're more natural. Our ancestors have been exposed to them. Our bodies can deal with them. And I almost look at these fake estrogens as a whole different situation, because our ancestors for thousands of years, we've never been exposed to BPA. That's completely artificial. Our gut bacteria don't know how to deal with that as well. We've never been exposed to phthalates, like some of these plastic chemicals or sunscreen chemicals or artificial red dyes and on, like some of these herbicides that act like estrogen, these pesticides. And so those are more concerning to me. Agent Orange, right? Like these fake man-made chemicals that disrupt your hormones. Now, hopefully you're not exposed to Agent Orange. So my focus in my book and in my research, of course, is more the chemicals that we might be exposed to every day. That's what I would worry about. I don't want you exposed to chemicals every single day that are disrupting your estrogen in some kind of weird way. And you just don't even know about it because nobody's ever said anything.
Absolutely. And I think you really hit the nail on the head in the story that you just wove together, because part of the problem with estrogen receptors is that they are widely distributed throughout the body. You know, we started way back with men and testosterone. Well, I mean, testosterone kind of just does a few things. It's there for sex drive, it's there for hair, it's there for masculinization and growth. You get beyond that, it's kind of like, okay, I don't need any more of this, because excessive testosterone leads to these very toxic states. Estrogen, you can tolerate many, many, many different levels, and you can tolerate different types of estrogens throughout the different areas of the body. So when it comes to a debate like soy, of course there's going to be huge individual variation, and we only glanced upon the idea of how genetics plays into this. And then, as you mentioned, soy is a commodity product. And the reason it's a commodity product is because most of it is low quality, genetically modified, and chronically exposed to herbicides and pesticides, and also growing in completely nutrient deficient soy that makes none of it good for us. And then another thing that you mentioned that I just want to drive home for our listeners is way back when we started this conversation, we talked about the chicken skin and about how estrogens kind of stick on that chicken skin because it's fatty. And really and truly, our whole body is fatty. And as I was listening to you, I was starting to be like, okay, but if I've got a little bit of soy here and a little bit of phthalates here and a little bit of parabens here and a little bit of atrazine here and a little bit of red food dyes, which you mentioned, it's all adding up to me having layers upon layers of very sticky molecules in my body that just stick around and have very long lives within my body. So a little bit scary. Now, I want to get at something else that you've hinted at, which is nomenclature. Because everybody talks about BPA, and my baby's bottles are BPA free. But BPA doesn't mean that it doesn't have BPS, and it's basically the same exact molecule. And we see that throughout all of the plasticizers, like the phthalates and the parabens. There's a bajillion names for them. I think it's much more publicized. People understand that there's 1,000 ways that you can say sugar on a label, but there's almost infinite numbers of ways that you can say estrogenic on a label. So talk to us a little bit about, where do we even start in being a good consumer when there is such redundancy in the language and such a lack of regulation of, like, well, if we know BPA is dangerous, perhaps we should ban these other 15 related molecules as well.
Right. Yeah, it's always better whenever you're developing chemicals that our ancestors have never been exposed to and we have zero knowledge about, it's always better to be on the safer side in terms of safety and assume it's bad for you than to just assume. And again, it's complicated because they're not killing cells, right, in these unique situations. And it's also further complicated, like you mentioned, because they're building up. So, you know, if you just, like a lot of researchers, they just study BPA. That's all they study. And it's surprising how against BPA they are, how they're out, you know, picketing and talking about how terrible it is for people and raising awareness. But that's all they study and that's all they talk about, just BPA. But then you throw in the phthalates and you talk to the phthalate researchers, PHTHALATES, phthalates. And those guys hate the phthalates. They can't believe how bad they are for people. And they're out picketing and talking about phthalates. And then you talk to the, you know what I mean? Like, you just go down the list and you talk to all these people. And what I tried to do in my book is to put them all together, like you're talking about, and say, look, they're all, it's 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 eventually equals 100, or at least 10. If you've got 10 of these chemicals in your body, they're acting on the same receptors, which is generally the alpha receptor. It's the problematic receptor, if you do the research specifically. And that's a bigger problem than even the BPA researchers are raising awareness for, or even the phthalate researchers, because they are just thinking about it in terms of one chemical. But if you put them all into your system, it's amplifying the toxicity. So there's that, but it's even more amplifying just the effects of how it's disrupting your hormones. And, you know, you made a good point. I mean, BPA free, you know, when I was publishing my book on this topic, basically it was just BPA free is good, and that's the end of the story. And there was a paper that came out around that same time that showed, you know, they tested BPS, which is a really common analog of BPA. It's very similar structure to BPA. So BPA stands for bisphenol A, and then they started making bisphenol S. And then they also tested bisphenol F. Like you said, there's almost indefinite amounts of these. You can just basically keep going down the alphabet. You can add multiple letters of the alphabet. You can make BPAF, for example. You can just keep tweaking it. It's just like testosterone and trying to fool the drug tests. And they tested these different analogs, these different variants of BPA, and they found they all act like estrogen. In fact, some of them are worse than BPA for your health. And so outlawing BPA isn't really a solution, because then you just push these companies in a weird way to make worse chemicals and to call it BPA free, so everybody thinks it's fine. And the phthalates are the same. In fact, phthalates are even a bigger class of chemicals, and so are the parabens. Like parabens, there's methylparaben, propylparaben, butylparaben. They're just on and on and on. And it's even more complicated than just studying methylparaben, which nobody really, like a lot of people don't usually get that specific. But the problem is your body modifies those to, there's different breakdown products of parabens after you eat the darn thing. So then you've got to study the modified pieces of the parabens that also act like estrogen. And this is well established. And so to come out and say like, oh, methylparaben's not that dangerous, but butylparaben is. Well, it's like, did you study the breakdown products in your body? Them, they call them metabolites. Did you study that when you made these conclusions? And most of the time the answer is no, not really. And so it's a really challenging situation. And I mean, the good news is now we're doing research on epigenetics, and I've done a lot of research at the Mayo Clinic on this. And, you know, you can use epigenetics, which are marks on the DNA. It's not the DNA itself. It's actually physical marks on the DNA generally. And you can see how these chemicals are interacting with these marks on your DNA. And hopefully we can develop some kind of a test where you just expose cells to some of these estrogen chemicals and you look at how are they messing up your DNA. It's like scratching a CD. Are they scratching that CD? It's really hard to erase that scratch. And then that would be maybe a better test for just classifying something as an estrogenic, something that's disrupting your natural estrogen. And, you know, I don't know if you want to launch into a whole epigenetic discussion right now, but it's a little deep, but I can simplify it if you want to go that route, or stick with basically the bigger picture.
Before we get to the rest of my interview, let's take a break for a word from our sponsors. As many of you know, I have a long-standing history with Young Living. It all started many years ago when I sat in my living room floor and inhaled a bottle of essential oil. And I know it sounds crazy, but I knew my life was going to change. And it did. And in some of the ways that it changed, I didn't love, because I spent hours researching Young Living's products. And what I would find is conflicting information that seemed over the top and sometimes unbelievable. I struggled to find evidence-based research about essential oils, about supplements. And all of that meant that not only did it take me time, but it made it more difficult for me to share products with others, help people understand that there was core science behind essential oils and behind supplements. fast forward more than 7 years, and I have studied Young Living's products extensively, answered hundreds and thousands of questions from members around the world. And I realized that many people were still facing the same basic problem that I had. Where do you find reliable, meaningful, easy to understand, accessible information about Young Living's products? There wasn't any place to find it. That's when I decided we got to fix this problem. And the Wild Ed Club was founded. The Wild Education Club is the largest collection of Young Living education and business tools that exists anywhere in the world. There are hundreds of product videos, courses that go into really in-depth product information as well as body system information, because I personally don't think it's enough just to know products. You have to know how the body works so that you can become intuitive and understand how to select the products that are right for you and your family. If you're brand new to essential oils, or if you just want a refresher course, I have a free 26-part jumpstart course. It has 26 videos that explain what essential oils are, how they're extracted from plants, how you use them, how do you care for your diffuser, how do you make DIYs and protect your investment and be sure that you're getting out of your oils what you pay for them. All you have to do is head to yledclub.com/jumpstart and you can download the course for free. If you love the course and you think that maybe you want to give it a go, remember, your first week in the Wild Education Club is always free. And when you act now and head over to wildedclub.com, sign up using the code PODCAST21, and it will save you 20% off your annual subscription to the Wild Ed Club. All you have to do is head to www.wildedclub.com and use the code PODCAST21 at checkout to save 20% off of your annual subscription. And now, let's get back to the show. Well, I think what's so fascinating about epigenetics is that it gives people power, which is what I am all about. I think that so often we think that we're helpless in the face of health and wellness issues and problems and all that. But I think epigenetics is like, well, I know my DNA. I know that I've got these harmful molecules that, because of the diversity of the estrogen receptor, are kind of harmful-ish to some people and extremely harmful to other people. And I know I'm over here on this spectrum. And so there are things that I can do in my life to help me avoid what's going on. So without getting too deep, give us just a crash course in, like, what does epigenetics in relation to estrogen and estrogenics have to do? Like, how does it become real in my everyday life?
Of course, I do DNA consulting too. So obviously I'm a little bit biased, but I also recognize the power of DNA just as a little preview. Like, for example, if somebody has a problem converting beta carotene to retinol in their genetics, well, then they shouldn't be supplementing beta carotene. They should be either supplementing retinol or getting retinol from their diet. So you can fix bad genes, even though, you know, it's not, you're not actually altering the gene. You're just taking a different supplement or something. But epigenetics are unique, like you say, because you can actually change them. So it's almost like having a bad gene and then, like, literally erasing it and putting in a different gene. And the best analogy I use for epigenetics, or that I've come across, is musical notes. Because if you've got black lines, you got a staff, and you've got musical, like, black dots on the staff, musical notes, da, 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 that's like your DNA. The melody is your DNA. Really simple. You can pass that sheet music to somebody else. They can play the same song. It's easy. You keep passing that on. It doesn't really change. But if you add chords, you add notes on top of those notes, well, now you've got epigenetics. You still have the melody. The DNA is still there. But now you've got chords, right? Now you've got multiple notes on top of those DNA notes. And you can pass that song to somebody else. And what's cool about it is you can keep the same melody, but you can change the chords or you can change the other notes. And the song sounds different. And you can manipulate that. And that's exactly what happens with epigenetics is we pass on those marks on our DNA. So even though the genetics don't change, the health can be impacted for multiple generations. And you can measure that stuff. And it's kind of in its infancy. And it's way more complicated than genetics because, you know, there's physical marks on your DNA called methylations, but then there's sumalations and ubiquitinations and acetylations. Like there's all these different types of epigenetic changes and you know, it's complicated.
Well, and if you make it really simple, it's just there's a zillion different kinds of enzymes that can act on a zillion different kinds of molecules. And it's all this really delicate dance to a song that can be written and rewritten. And people do have those opportunities to make some good choices in their days to help them to take better control of their future. So thinking about what would you say if someone's listening to this and they go, you know what, I've never really thought of this in my everyday life. What are some of like the biggest things that for people who are looking for those absolutes, what are some just like absolutely you can cut this off today, as well as like here's a few things that you're not going to be able to cut off, and it may take you weeks to months to years to work on this, but here's how you can begin walking down this path.
Right. Personal care products and water. You got to filter your water today. Get activated charcoal. Activated charcoal removes all these estrogen chemicals. So that's pretty straightforward. And if you have like a reverse osmosis system or somewhere where it's going into plastic and it's just sitting there, the longer it sits in plastic, the more leaching you're going to get with estrogen chemicals. But at least it's not like coming in with estrogen chemicals because the reverse osmosis is filtering them out. I'm a bigger fan of like a pump reverse osmosis system. There's a company called Purify Guru, for example. They make the only one that I know of. But there's other, I mean, obviously most filters have activated charcoal. That's the absolute essential. You got to have activated charcoal to get rid of these chemicals. But then, like I say, I'm very leery about plastics and especially liquids, even room temperature. I know heating up accelerates the leaching and it's more problematic, but there's plenty of leaching at room temperature. And it's just a question of how sensitive are you? How much are these things building? How many sources in all these different areas are you getting exposures from? So I try and cut the plastics as much as I can. When I'm traveling, I'll have plastic bottles, whatever. You just have to do what you got to do. But certainly at home, I've got glass. I've got stainless steel. You know, my Tupperware's glass. So that's a really immediate change that people can make that I think is really worth making. And if you're storing dry foods or something in plastic, it's no big deal. You're not leaching in a dry substance. But then the personal care, I mean, that's a huge one because that's where most people are getting their estrogen exposures outside of drinking water. And there's so many chemicals that you can have. And like I say, you can hide them on the label. So what you end up needing to do is find a company you can trust or look at, or something you can actually read the ingredients and, or honestly just go fragrance free, which is mostly what I do. And then you can end up with fairly inexpensive personal care products oftentimes that are actually really good. And it's amazing. Like when we go to the in-laws and they do we have our laundry, I've got four kids and we do their laundry. It obviously smells all of a sudden. We got all this new fragrance stuff because they're using conventional laundry detergent. But then when you go back to our house, we got the fragrance-free laundry detergent. It takes like 3 or 4 cycles of laundry to get that smell out. So it's similar to shampoo and conditioner, all this stuff. It really clings to the clothes. It's hard to wash that stuff out. It's not trivial. And they've even done dermal uptake studies of people like with clothing that has fragrance and how much gets into your blood. It's a real thing. And speaking of dermal uptake, like skin uptake, after I published my book, they did a study on sunscreen chemicals And I classify this kind of in the personal care product category because a lot of shampoos and all this lotions, they'll have oxybenzone. They'll have this nasty sunscreen estrogen chemical that's illegal in a lot of countries, and it's acting like estrogen. And some people call it benzophenone 3. That's a synonym for oxybenzone. Unfortunately, all these names are goofy and really silly, but you know, it's just chemists. It's just what they do. And oxybenzone, they measured, they did one application of sunscreen, humans, not rats, not an animal study, one application. 7 days later, those people had blood levels of oxybenzone that was above the government's own recommended safety limits. 7 days after one application of sunscreen. So,
what so scares me about this study is, like, I'm sure they were like, we applied a 2-inch by 2-inch patch. It wasn't like you're slathering your entire body with it for 6-8 hours over the course of 2-3 days on a vacation.
Yeah, it was insane. And like I said, the government's own safety limits are really kind of absurd anyways, because they're looking for cancer causing levels and things like that, because that's what you find in toxicology studies. So those levels are really high. Like, I have much higher standards than that, or much more stringent standards. Like, I think we should be exposed to far less. And so zinc sunscreen is a great way to go, a great alternative. It works. You don't need oxybenzone. It's very difficult to find, unfortunately. And it's funny because a lot of companies market, they'll say like, oh, our shampoo is the best because it blocks ultraviolet degradation. It blocks the UV from the sun. That's because they're putting these sunscreen chemicals in the sun, in the shampoo. So you find it in a lot of different sources where you wouldn't really expect. So personal care products, overall picture, water, personal care, fix those. You've done 90%, maybe 70%.
And minimize the plastics, and then you're getting in that extra 20.
Well, there's always like in our daily environments, like there's going to be linoleum floors and plastic shower curtains and others, and that stuff does leach into the air to some degree. And so that's like the long-term, like 10-year strategy, where it's like, oh, I'm buying a new mattress, let me try and find one that's not leaching all kinds of plastics, vinyls and stuff into the air. But again, like, don't go throwing out, like, that's the long-term thing that you want to just work on over time.
Yeah, it is scary. I've never fully conceptualized the leaching of plastics from a shower curtain, for example. But think about it, listeners. What are you inhaling? That aroma that is coming off of it is these plasticized, you know, they're plastic fragrance molecules, and they're leaching out of these petroleum-based products. No bueno. Perhaps a bit of a grim question. Why is there no regulation of estrogenic compounds in the United States, as there is widely across Europe, widely across other parts of the world? Because I think about it, and it's almost laughable. It's like, well, if the US and China, the two largest producers of goods in the world, are going to carelessly put a blind eye towards this, like, we're all on this planet together, and it's just one big toxic soup that we're creating. And so why is there no regulation? And where do we even begin to encourage regulation?
Yeah, part of it is the scientists' fault directly, because they've been doing the toxicology studies and telling everybody that it's fine because it's not toxic. And that message is incorrect, really, because it is toxic over the long term. It just maybe takes decades to alter your epigenetics and screw up your hormones and all that, but it's not killing the cells. It's not causing the cancer. Usually it can get to those levels, but that's the first part problem, is the scientists themselves, oftentimes they're not either speaking out enough about it, or they're just looking at one chemical and they're not looking at all these other ones that are factoring in. And then they're not looking at they're just purely focused on toxicity and cell death. You know, the politicians too, of course, are a big part of the blame, because they're taking money from these giant corporations. I mean, we have to get rid of like monetary influence on our politicians behind the scenes. You know, like, I've seen memes and things, like, it's almost like these race car drivers that you have all these stickers all over your shirts because there's so much funding from all these politicians. It's the same way, but it's not transparent, unfortunately. So people don't see it as vividly, and they don't oftentimes recognize it whereas a lot of countries don't have it. Like, I have a scientist friend, Michael Skinner. He gave a TED talk. He raises about 5,000 mice at any given time in his lab, and he studies multiple generations of infertility and how much more infertile you get when you get exposed to these chemicals in future generations. And he gave a talk over in Europe about one of these chemicals. And 2 weeks later, and this was like a bunch of years ago, 2 weeks later, they outlawed that chemical. 2 weeks. And in America, that chemical is still legal. Like, we're still cooking along. It's a fungicide. They spray it on foods and stuff for fungus. And it's a problem because these companies make a ton of money and they really are influential and they want to protect their assets. They just see it as kind of like an indifferent thing. It's just a game. It's just money. And nobody, no one person is to blame because it's all just, you know, meetings of shareholders and all this kind of thing.
Oh, no good at all. It just drives me, batty. And I don't know nearly as much about estrogens in the environments as I do about, because we've just spent almost an hour talking about the risks of estrogens in the environment and how pervasive they are. And the same conversation could be had for pharmaceuticals. The same conversation could be said for all types of food additives throughout the entire manufacturing process. It's a whole big mess. Well, before we go, I would love to know, as it relates to estrogens in the environment and in our bodies, or as it relates to just the world in general, what out there on the frontiers gives you hope for our future?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, number one, there's a lot of good environmentalism and recognition of all these plastics. And they're doing some, like, there's a guy named Boylan Slat from the Netherlands. He's literally like a 20-year-old, super young guy. I think he started this when he was like 16, but he's literally clearing up the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is just basically like a plastic island the size of Texas. It's not literally an island, but it's just...
I don't know how many listeners and me are just like, wait, there's a Great Pacific Garbage Patch? That's really sad. Okay, do continue telling us about Mr. Boylan Slat.
Yeah, exactly. There's people like that. I mean, I was talking to a guy in Maine. I was on a hunting trip in Maine, and I was at the bar. We were actually watching a Patriots game. This was a while ago when I lived in Boston, and I was telling him about my book when I was writing it. And I was telling him about infertility, and he was, by the way, he was an organic farmer. He was really dialed into a lot of these chemicals and the problems. And I was telling him about infertility, and he was saying, well, I'm kind of glad we're humans are going infertile and all this. And I'm like, wow, it's weird that somebody would say that, first of all. But then I told him, look, they've done studies on polar bears. They tested 11 polar bears in northern Alaska, and they're full of parabens. And they've got these chemicals in their fat cells, and they're getting infertile. And he goes, oh, wow, good point. Like, it's funny, you know, like, almost no matter who you're talking to, if they're trying to protect the planet, or they're protecting their personal health just selfishly, or they're protecting their families, or just humans in general, there's a lot of good incentives to fix these problems. But the first and foremost thing comes from recognition. I feel like that's been growing, and that's the good news, is that, again, when I started writing about this, people didn't have a clue that there was all these different estrogens coming from different directions. And that's the important thing to recognize. And once you recognize that, knowledge is power. You start doing something about it, and other people start doing something. So it's kind of a grassroots thing. It's not going to happen from the corporate levels, because there's too much money incentivizing them not to do anything different. It has to start with personal care product choices, plastic eliminations whenever you can, and just talking about this.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not surprising to me that polar bears have parabens and phthalates, because I feel like we've barely skimmed the surface, because you mentioned a moment ago about how eliminating these chemicals is so difficult, because it's not like they just get in and then irreversibly bind a receptor. The ones that don't irreversibly bind those receptors, then your body has to metabolize them to get rid of them. It's not like they're water soluble and are just like, bye. And to the point of the polar bears, they also accumulate up the food chain and over time. Oh, it seems like a lot, but we're just going to all remember water filtering, personal care product choice, and minimizing plastics is where we can all start. Dr. Anthony J., thank you so much for being the guest today on the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Lindsay. I appreciate it.
The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Kelsey Lorman. Production design, sound design, and editing is by Jive Media. If you have a question about this or any other episode of the podcast, send us an email to hello@lindsayelmoreshow.com. And hey, since you're still here, take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. And while you're at it, go over and follow us on Instagram @LindsayElmoreShow. This helps us bring the pod to more people.